Session number 10059.
Sir Geoffrey Cox, Realtor.
These militiamen were very often just sitting around the place, cutting a slice off a loaf of bread, opening a tin of sardines or a tin of herrings, or rolling themselves cigarettes and lounging around in a state of what struck me as a state of complete disarray. I had had some military training myself because in New Zealand, when I grew up, we had a limited form of compulsory military service in which we had to do a certain number of drills at night and a certain an annual camp. We were all drafted members of the Territorial Army, and the basic principles of military discipline and warfare were known to me, and there was very little of that about at that time, it was and these chaps were all very frightened of any sound in the air. They had been quite heavily bombed and machine gunned in their trenches further south towards Toledo, and there is no doubt at all that they were in World War II parlance bomb happy, and that it took only the slightest sound of an aircraft to give them considerable alarm. At the time, I thought this was a sign of their being clearly not untrained troops, but of course I found in World War II that even trained troops, until they got accustomed to aircraft attack, were liable to get very nervy and very scared.
You talked about going up to the front line in this kind of way, but I recollect from reading the memoirs of Kim Philby in Spain how he got arrested when he tried to do the same on the Franco side.
I think things were much more easier on the Republican side, partly because of the variety of authorities, so that although you might get blocked by one of them equally, you got a fairly free run from them. Secondly, the Republican people and the Republican government were so absolutely convinced of the rightness of their cause that they were very eager to have the international press anywhere around. And the knowledge that a journalist was there opened doors to you rather than closed doors. And the third thing was that the organization on the Republican side was sufficiently slack for them to be no effective policing of the areas near the front. Because I went forward a day or two later when Franco was on the verge of. When he got very close to Madrid with the German photographer because I wanted to get him to take a photograph of me in the trenches because the News Chronicle had made great play in a poster in London of its correspondent in Paris crouched behind a sandbag barricade on the bridge over the River Irun at Ondi. Atoran, the River Atoran, I forgot the name of the river now, and I thought it would do me no harm if I got my photograph in the papers in this way, and we found some chaps digging a trench on the outskirts of Madrid, and there was no sign that this was anything other than a reserve trench, so I duly got into position, and the cameraman went a bit ahead to get a photograph of me crouched beside these militiamen when all of a sudden a shell burst almost alongside him and we were in fact in the front line, though we hadn't even realized it, so chaotic was the place. But mainly they were, and particularly once the fighting got into the outskirts of Madrid, if you went forward to the barricades, in Carabanchel, or also when they began to get on the edge of the university city, they were very pleased to see you, very confident of their of their what they thought to be the rightness of their cause, and therefore I never had any problem in getting to the front in Madrid other than the logistical one. And once the fighting got established in and around the university city, it then became also much more difficult because the lines of communication were quite often heavily shelled, and it was very often difficult to persuade anybody to show you where to go forward, let alone come forward with you.
Did you come across in the Madrid area any signs of opposition to the Republic amongst civilians?
No, none that I could observe. The only sign, only knowledge I had of this was of that after I'd been there a few days, before Franco got right to the edge of the city, I went out one night with one of the American correspondents in a police car, which was there for the purpose of hunting down fifth columnists. And they argued that in the fashionable suburbs of Madrid, government trucks and cars were fired on regularly at night by snipers placed in wealthy flats. And so they had cars in which a chap with a light machine gun sat in the back seat, and the car drove slowly down the street in the hope of attracting fire, the idea being that you then spotted where the fire came from and you moved in. But in fact, we spent a night patrolling up and down these streets and found nothing at all of any excitement except a light clearly on a top floor. And this gave the police that we were with a great sense of excitement, because they were quite sure this must be a man signaling to the enemy aircraft. And they swooped into the building, and when the man refused to put the light out, they fired at the window, and an indignant face appeared at the window, the chap absolutely furious, explaining that he was doing his packing, he was off to the front the next day, and what the hell did they want to interrupt him when he was busy getting ready to go off to do his duty by the Republic. But on the other hand, I didn't have the contacts with the pre-July Madrid, but those correspondents who did, and particularly Decaux, a great Times correspondent of that time, who was a Frenchman who was acting as the Times who was the Times correspondent, he certainly told me later, this was after the battle had begun, of people who were being taken from their homes and shot at night by the Republicans. But of outward sign of opposition, none whatsoever.
What was the spirit of the civilians in Madrid in these initial stages of the siege of the city?
Surprisingly good. When you consider that they... And also surprisingly unalarmed. I was astonished at how the cinemas kept open, people kept charging around the place. You had a sense of very much of life as usual. I was going to say business as usual, but that would not have been the appropriate term. And it was only when you got to the Saturday, the 7th of November, when we all thought that the Franco troops would be in, that you got then the streets began to be deserted, and a real sense of apprehension was in the air. But right up to that moment before that, there was surprisingly little sign of tension or strain. But by the 7th, there was no doubt this was by that time a city at war, and it was by this time also a dangerous city to move about in, that At night in the dark, there were rifle shots going off all the time. I think these were as often as not nervy guards shooting at shadows. And that was when we moved out of the hotel that we were in on the Grand Via and moved into the British Embassy, to sleep in the British Embassy, because we were of the view, the British press, that the Moors once came through, there wouldn't be much time to explain to them that we were decent, self-respecting journalists and not Republicans who should have a bullet put in them very quickly. We moved back into the Grand Via by day, but we all continued to sleep in the embassy right until the time I left, about midway through December. The only other sign I had of people who were at risk from the Republicans, though not, were two signs. I saw this extraordinary sight when the model prison was evacuated, and as the fighting got near to it. This was 3 or 4 days after the attack was fully joined, and we went down there in the evening, and the whole courtyard was filled with people with this terrible prison pallor, and their unshaven faces, I recollect them as each having a blanket around his neck, but that may not have been all of them, and they were standing in lines apathetically waiting to go into buses, and it must have been nerve-wracking for them, because here were their liberators, as they would have seen it, within a rifle shot away, because you could hear the battle going on in the background very clearly. And of course these were the chaps who were massacred, taken out of their buses and shot by the anarchists on the road outside Madrid. And another occasion, the Republicans raided one of the South American embassies next door to the British embassy. And Sefton, Delmer and I were coming down the road to the British embassy and suddenly found ourselves in the middle of a ferocious, short-lived battle as the police and Republican guards smashed in the gate of this embassy, and there were shots firing all over the place. And our problem was that the guards on the British embassy, thinking we were members of people who had taken refuge in this South American embassy trying to flee, were very reluctant to open the embassy gate to us. But we finally got in.
Was Madrid, as far as you could see, a city in which a socialist revolution was being pushed forward?
Yes. There again, you had everywhere these cars, requisitioned cars and lorries with the initials of the unions on them. The Ritz was, I think, a workers' kitchen, or was it a hospital? I know there was one great hotel that had been turned into a hospital. I think the Ritz was at that time simply one of these great public restaurants where you got a cheap meal. Everybody was dressed in a what passed in those days for proletarian style. That is, there were nobody was wearing clothes of any smartness at all. We rapidly did away with our own collars and ties, and wore an open shirt and a jacket. And there were guards on all corners, and it was a mixture of a city of war and a city in revolution.
The reason I ask this question is because there is a controversy amongst left-wing people, particularly between communists and people who say they are to the left of the communists, about this question, in that the communists are supposed to have wanted to prevent sections of the middle class being alienated by not pushing the revolution on too far, so that the war wasn't jeopardized.
Yes, and I think that what I've said would not clash with that, because the regular life of the community went on. Shops were open and they didn't have much to sell. The bootblacks were busy in the Puerto del Sol. The cinemas were open. There was quite clearly very little private property had been expropriated at that stage. That the power, the manifest, the outward signs of power were those of the unions and of the left. Whether or not factories had been taken over to what degree, I don't know, because of course I was so busy covering the war that I had no time to, at that stage, to investigate that.
You mentioned the British Embassy. Did you have any contact with Western diplomats?
Well, the only one I had any dealings with was Forbes, Ogilvy Forbes, who was the chargé d'affaires, and whom I thought was a very sensible chap indeed. He was too busy to see us often. And we, strangely enough, I don't recollect any British journalist consistently going to the embassy for information. We slept in the ballroom. We were very glad to have a cup of coffee and a bit of bread for our breakfast, and then we went out and did our work. We had refuge from them. We, on a couple of occasions, the British correspondents talked to the chargé d'affaires. I think it was Ogilvy Forbes, wasn't it?
Yes. Going back to what you were saying about the massacre of the prison inmates, did you have any personal evidence of that?
No, but the facts, I think, are very well established, because the anarchists took this action in the face of the command of the Spanish the Republican government, and I'm sure you'll find that, although I haven't got at my fingertips the proof of it, it's certainly Hugh Thomas in his book on the Spanish Civil War has got the proof of it.
Some of the international brigaders I've spoken to make various accusations about British diplomats in Spain, saying that they were hampering the Republican cause. Did you personally feel that?
There's no evidence of that in my time, and I would have thought that they, what they were doing was carrying out punctiliously the instructions of their government, and I would have thought that the government, of course, was following a policy of non-intervention, which tended to be a policy of really hampering the Republic's chances of securing arms. But the only argument you could possibly make was that the embassy did not open its doors to any member of the International Brigade, or was not prepared to do anything to help anybody from the International Brigade. Similarly, they were also not prepared to take refugees, Franco refugees, inside the embassy. And there was, of course, a great hullabaloo when it was discovered that one of the Romilly brothers, I think it was the older brother Giles, had spent a night in the embassy as a guest of Sefton Delmer, and also among the journalists in the who slept in the embassy was a man whose name escapes me for the moment, who was a deserter from the International Brigade, who had managed to get himself taken on as Delmer's assistant, Scott Watson, one of the many eccentric figures that gather around civil wars. And Delmer made him his assistant, and there was some anger when the British embassy discovered that they had on the premises a man who could have been sought by the Republic as a deserter from their forces.
I think some of the international brigaders I've spoken to have accused British diplomats of trying to get international brigade members to desert the Spanish Republican Army.
Well, there was no sign of that in the time that I was there, but of course I was there only in the very early stages of the heavy fighting in Madrid, and I would have thought it was very unlikely that they would have done anything of the kind. So there's no evidence of that as far as I was concerned.
Can you tell me about your own contact with the international brigades, and in particular the British battalion?
Well, I had, alas, no contact with what was then merely a British platoon in the Talman battalion in the line, because on the two occasions when I went forward to try to see them, they were out of the line. So my contacts with them were mainly when they came back on leave, and which, of course, was very easy to do in Madrid. I mean, after all, people came back from the line on a tram car, had a bath, went to the pictures, and went back to the battle again. And this is when I saw, on several occasions, Sam Russell, Esmond Romilly, and others who were members of the what was then the British platoon, this was shortly before they had very heavy losses in the First Battle of Boadilla. But I'm not, alas, a witness to the days of the battalion itself, because I didn't cover that. I'd gone back to England before the Jarama River fighting, and they were at this time simply a small unit within the Talman battalion, and as I say, my contact with them, I never saw them in action. My contact with them was always out of the line, either when they were in their billets at the back of the area to the north, or when they, but more often, they were eager to come and seek us out in the telephone building, which were the press headquarters, because, among other things, we could give them a chance to have a bath in the hotel at the Grand Vier, because we still slept in the British Embassy, two or three of us had rooms as well in the Grand Vier, where we occasionally slept, but mainly in order to be able to have a base from which you could work, and it amounted really to an office in the centre of Madrid.
What did you make of these young men from the British upper middle classes who joined the International Brigade?
On the whole, truly admirable. Particularly these early people were all sincere people. There was no doubt the occasional adventurer among them, but they were genuine, responsible chaps who wanted to stand up against what they felt was a force that was wrong. I think at this stage the idea that it was also a force endangering Britain was not uppermost in their minds. These were the bulk of the early volunteers in the International Brigade were either communists or people who were close to the communists in their ideas, and they certainly were very strongly anti-fascist. And it's difficult now, to over these many years, to explain why fascism appeared a very real danger to us then, but it did appear a very real danger. We felt that we were fighting to keep our own country from ultimately going authoritarian, and that and in the case of Spain, this was allied to a feeling that the gallant Spanish people were being made the victims of the power of the Nazis and Mussolini. And one must remember that the Spanish Civil War broke out only 6 months after the British government had called upon the British people to be ready to run the risk of war in opposing Mussolini in Abyssinia. And in the autumn of 35, there was a great upsurge of feeling in Britain that which Churchill takes note of in his volume on the period, when suddenly people felt here was the international order, the League of Nations, standing up for right, and this was quite different to the old nationalist wars. This was a chance to build a real new order based on peace, and there was a surge of idealism. And a very real a sense that we might have to go and fight. I remember in the News Chronicle newsroom, we would discuss with great earnestness whether it would be better to go into the infantry or try to get into the Air Force. We looked the possibility of war in the face and found that we'd have to face it. Now, some of that idealism, of course, was completely blunted and smashed within weeks by the Hall of Owl Pact and the realization that while the government had been calling for a stand against in the name of international order, it had been busy doing a deal behind the scenes. I don't say necessarily we might have been better off if the Hall of Owl Pact had been done, because at least it would have saved part of Abyssinia, but it was the hypocrisy of it that shocked people. And that same idealism, I think, animated the people that fought in Spain. And no doubt, as the numbers grew much larger, and you no doubt got a wider range of people who were just cynical or out for adventure, but it took a lot of guts and a lot of genuine idealism to put yourselves into the hands of a foreign army which shot its deserters, which was very tough in its discipline, and put yourself at risk. And the early international brigaders, I have nothing but the most profound respect, because they were people who put their lives on the line for an ideal and voluntarily, and that takes quite a bit of doing.
Could you make a judgment on Esmond Romilly?
Yes, I think Esmond Romilly was one of those. There was the streak of the maverick, as there is in the whole of that Romilly family. They are curiously almost exhibitionist family, and there was a touch of that in Esmond, but basically, he had volunteered and took the risks that came his way. I knew his brother Giles much better, and Giles did a longer stint than Esmond. And I remember talking to him after he'd left Spain, and we were talking about the question of courage, and he said, I can honestly say that I've not ever taken a decision based upon fear. He said I've never gone out of the way to prove whether I had courage or not. But he said I've in all honesty can say that I've done what I thought was the right thing at the time. He said quite often within a matter of a month or two I've decided it wasn't the right thing, but nevertheless at the time I was sincere. And these were very sincere people. A number of them, of course, were party members who had been drafted in. Quite a lot of the early members of the International Brigade had simply been rung up by their local party secretary and said, your duty to the party is to go off and enlist. But they did so at a time when it was still possible for these chaps to retain a sincere faith in communism, because after all, by 36, the show trials had not got underway. You had the appalling example of the mass collectivization, But that was very rigorously brushed under the carpet by the bulk of the British press, and therefore,